Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
How can you have a good brand if you haven't established a company culture? How can you have a culture if you don't fully understand your brand? And what do either of these two terms really mean? Well, lucky for you, that's exactly what we're going to talk about with my guest today. What's up, storytellers? Welcome back to the Storytelling Lab. This is episode 144, and today I have not one, but two amazing guests, Mark Miller and Ted Vaughn, the authors, the co-authors of Culture Built My Brand. My background is in documentary filmmaking. I have done a lot of work over the years with nonprofit organizations, and I'm still passionate about that. That is the world that Ted and Mark come from, helping nonprofits understand their culture and brand, but it really applies to anybody, specifically small to medium businesses or solopreneurs or nonprofits, anyone that, as I like to say, is overwhelmed and under-resourced, right? You have so many things on your plate, so many things to do that often things like culture and brand get neglected. Listen, I'm a co-founder of a startup right now. Same thing happens with those type of teams where it's scrappy and you don't have a lot of people and everyone wears multiple hats, and it's real easy to focus on, if you're a nonprofit, maybe the cause or the purpose or the mission, and if you're a startup or a commercial enterprise, just the bottom line or just making money and just trying to find out your product without establishing the culture and brand. Now, as Ted and Mark will say, and really any branding expert will tell you, it is never too early to start thinking about that culture and brand, because it determines and dictates all the decisions you make moving forward about who your product is for and how you deliver it and your why behind everything. Now, historically, people view these two things, culture and brand, as separate concepts, if you will. You know, the culture that you have at your company and what that looks like, and the brand, the outward representation of that company. However, what I love so much about this conversation and their book is it talks about, first of all, that's inaccurate and incorrect, but secondly, how and why they intersect and the power that you can leverage when you do that effectively. This is the final episode of season 10 of the Storytelling Lab, and it is an amazing one to go out on because I was really, really impressed with not only their knowledge and their grasp of the concept, but their ability to convey the concepts, you know, deep, dense, nuanced concepts in simple visual ways. So the way they explained things was really helpful to me, and hopefully it will be to you as well. So, here is my conversation with Mark Miller and Ted Vaughn, and I hope that you love it.
Welcome to the Storytelling Lab, where we break down how to get to the heart of your story and the hearts of your audience to leave the greatest impact possible. And now, here's your host, award-winning filmmaker and writer, Rain Bennett.
What's up, my beautiful people? Welcome to another episode of the Storytelling Lab, where we help you break down the art and science of storytelling. My name is Rain Bennett. I am your host, and my job is to help you deepen your connections, increase your sales, and serve your audiences better. Every Tuesday morning, I send out a quick storytelling tip to my newsletter subscribers. I show you techniques I've learned along my journey and used in my own stories, as well as those of my clients. But most importantly, I leave you with tangible takeaways that you can apply to your brand storytelling immediately. Oh, well, actually, more importantly than that, it's free. If this would help you, sign up for the newsletter at rainbennett.com/weekly-storytelling-tips. Ted, Mark, welcome to the Storytelling Lab. Glad you're here.
Thanks for having us.
Grateful to be here.
Yes, absolutely. I was just telling you all that this is my first three-way on the show, so I'm very excited about what unexpected turns this conversation might take. Okay, so let's get into it. First thing, I love the book cover, and I want to dive into that. Just my first simple, straightforward question is the part where, you know, culture built my brand, and then the word eight was scratched out. I got to know the backstory and the meaning behind that. I'm sure it's, you know, this is not an original question, but still, I'm interested.
I mean, I'll start, and Mark can give the more accurate version. We've lived culture eating brands, and the book was written because it was our experience in the beginning of our kind of agency years of having amazing brand and amazing story and amazing solutions, and having the failure point be an inability for people, for leaders to own it, to communicate it, to message it, to cascade it, which is a culture problem. And we kept seeing it. We kept trying to address it. We kept factoring it into our work, but we didn't have any kind of formal approach or way to solve it. And it wasn't a core part of who we were at the time. So we just wanted to get this book written because it's really our blood, sweat, and tears that have gone into it. But the publisher thought it was way too negative and that really, really needed to be built. So being a design agency, we rolled with their recommendation, just with a little twist.
Yeah.
That's a great twist. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's all, like Ted said, it's all our learned lessons from interacting with organizations that just couldn't essentially tell their story well because they had something internally that kept them from doing it. And so you could have the greatest, I mean, we had clients paying us lots of money to do rebrands, and then they would never see the light of day because someone was afraid of something or they weren't involved in a meeting, and it would just all fall apart. And that was really shocking. So we came up with a clever way to kind of have both messages on the cover.
A lot of my audience are beginners, if you will, or, you know, part of the reason why I was excited to have you on is, like, I'm a documentary filmmaker, so I've worked with nonprofits my whole career. Those two worlds, you know, align very easily in terms of communicating messages and purpose, et cetera, et cetera. So I always have a soft spot in my heart for helping nonprofits speak at nonprofit conferences, et cetera. And a lot of them struggle with the same things that documentary filmmakers do, you know, lack of resources and money and, you know, sometimes technical know-how. And even if they aren't from a nonprofit world, that's still kind of who I seek to help is someone who's overwhelmed and under-resourced, if you will, right? So let's pretend, and I say that to say, sometimes I like to just bring it down and keep it grounded and, like, let's explain some maybe simple concepts for some people, but not for others. So talk to me about, in your definition, like, what is culture, what is brand, and then how they interact with each other.
I'll take culture, and then Mark, I'll pass the baton to you for brand. Sound good?
Yeah.
So, you know, I have kind of, or we have three very simple ways to understand culture. First, when we're talking about culture with our organizations, right, we're talking about organizational culture. Culture is one of those really blurry words that means a lot of things. So we're honing in on organizational culture, which for us, in the most simplest one-word definition, would be the how of the organization. It's not the what, not the why, not the where. It's the how we show up, how we do the work we do. My metaphor for culture is soil. because everything you do is planted in the soil of culture. Culture is either enriching and nourishing or depleting and hurting every single thing you're doing, whether you're for profit or nonprofit. The more academic definition is that culture is a series of behaviors that create patterns that reflect your actual values, primarily modeled by leadership. I mean, at the end of the day, leaders shape culture. So how they behave, their patterns of behavior are your culture, regardless of what you say.
I gotta just claim that the culture is soil. That's the first time you've ever said that is here on the Storytelling Lab. I have to believe that. But no, dude, it's so good. Like that, like to explain something visually like that, you must be designers. No, I really, really love that. Thank you. Such a great way to explain it. So brand.
Yeah, I go by the definition established by Marty Neumeier, who wrote Brand Gap and Designful Company and Scramble and all those great brand books and strategy books, which is basically that it's what other people say about your organization. It's their opinions, their thoughts, their feelings. And where that comes from, which is where we take brand to the next level, is your culture, right? Because if culture is how you show up, it's who you hire, it's what you budget, it's the decisions you make. Those all trickle down externally to those who you serve or your customers. And that ultimately shapes their opinions about you.
So do people, or organizations rather, tend to view these two concepts as separate entities or concepts? Yeah, you're nodding your head. So, okay.
That's the problem, right? Like, I think, and why we wrote the book, right, is because there's a ton written on organizational culture from the lens of it being healthy and building trust, and Patrick Lencioni and meetings and leadership, right? John Maxwell. There's a whole arsenal of stuff on culture through the lens of leadership and health. There's a whole arsenal of stuff on brand. There's very little about the integration of brand and culture. And yet, anybody who's gone through a rebrand knows culture is the tide that rises or lowers the success of that rebrand. Anybody who's addressed organizational culture health knows that if we get healthy, our brand tends to work better. So they're intimately connected. Just very little was written on, especially practically, very little practically was written on how to do it. And that's what the book was. The book was meant to be a practical methodology on how to approach these kind of abstract, ethereal subjects.
This applies to any organization, not just nonprofits, but when is the right point in sequencing to, I'm part of a small startup right now, very small, like less than six people, five people on the team. When is the right time to start having these conversations? Because when you are a small team or a startup or something like that, resources are limited, right? Time is limited. So we can't do everything all at the same time. And I know there are varying opinions on this. In your opinion, when is the right time to start having these conversations and start establishing and like putting the stakes in the ground of our culture, of our brand?
Yeah, I would say that it's at the beginning, because if you get too big, it becomes really hard to turn the ship, to change and shift your culture. And while you may not be able to do things that you would want to as at a larger size or more revenue or what have you, it's the spirit of those things that matters, right? And so in the book, we talk about the different layers of organizational culture. A lot of times when people say, oh, we have a great company culture, what they mean is there's a free cereal bar or free snacks or free beer. And those are what we call artifacts of culture. But there, what's the culture that decided that you should have those things for your employees? Because in some cases, those things could be good or bad, right? Is your intent to keep employees working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at your central office instead of working at home and spending time with their families? Or is it that you actually want them to save money and you don't want them to spend time driving around? Like, you can actually serve them. And so those are two different decisions, right? Of how you get to the point where we have a free snack bar, as an example.
Yeah. This is really interesting currently, because I don't know if this is a Gen Z thing or a post-pandemic thing, but culturally, we are really far away and pushing back against this whole thing. But we have a slide in the office or like ping pong tables, which for millennials, you know, 2010 or whatever, that was, you know, that was the jam, and like people don't care about that anymore. So I love that the artifacts of culture. What were you about to say, Ted?
I think there's this human desire to find the silver bullet, find the gimmick, and then cut and paste it into our organization because it works. Oh, Google's doing this, so we need a juice bar. Oh, we need scooters. Oh, we need really what matters is the leader's intent, followed by empathy. Mm. Like, do we know our people and care about them enough to make shifts in our brand that actually offer our employees value as much or even more as our customers? Because if we get the value prop right for our employees, it's amazing how that translates to value prop for customers.
This is such a good point. Like, so few people think about it like this. Like, just like your customers are going to be different than someone else's, so are your employees and what they care about and what they need to succeed. But it's like, even me saying it out loud, it's like it's a light bulb moment, and it shouldn't be, right? Yeah. Like, this is...
That's why I love the soil metaphor, because, you know, when I lecture on this, you know, I'm a wine guy. I love wine, and I love wine primarily because soil yields radically different grapes through radically different soil. So you've got soils that are customized to climate, to grapes, to growing conditions. Some are slate, some are soft, some are hard, some are calcareous. And it's a beautiful picture of culture. Culture is not meant to be one static thing, good, bad, healthy, unhealthy. You know, it's meant to be whatever the conditions you're in need to grow vital grapes.
Quick little tangent. I'm from Eastern North Carolina, which is rich in culture and history. And the Europeans, you know, when they came over here initially, could not get wine to, you know, could grapes to grow because they were growing European grapes, right? Which of course happened in California. So finally, it took them years and years to figure out the Scuppernong, you know, grape variety that produces this very sweet muscadine, you know, wine. But for the longest time, they're like, I can't get it. I can't do it. But it can grow that very well. Does it taste good? Do you like Scuppernong wine? Like,
yeah, I've actually tasted wine. That wine. I've done wine tasting in Virginia and in North Carolina and in other parts of the world where I'm glad for the effort, but not proud of the results.
Yes, it's thick, baby. It's thick. Yeah. Like everything down here. You're like our sweet tea. Okay. In this concept of culture and brand, what do you find? Let's shift into nonprofits specifically. And this is a big question, so maybe we chip away at it. What do nonprofits generally struggle with in terms of this? And listen, corporations do too, but we know some of them do it really well. But what do nonprofits uniquely struggle with when it comes to these kinds of, I don't know what to call it, but these concepts of that aren't just like bringing in revenue, right? I don't want to say like soft skills or soft concepts, but culture, brand, those things that are kind of in between that the what you do.
Yeah, I think the number one challenge most nonprofits face is that they have these incredible causes.
Yeah.
And so they put everything on that cause. So we don't need to care about our staff because they're here serving a greater good, right? We don't need to worry about our brand because we're helping people in Africa get clean water, and our donors will care about that. But you know, the first rule in marketing and branding is that no one cares. Mm-hmm. And so what's interesting about that is that people on the donor side, right, it's been shown that you have to disrupt them. They disrupt their thinking and their worldview to get them to consider making a financial contribution to your cause, right? And so we go along this whole time as nonprofits just saying, hey, help people get clean water, help people get clean water. And if you haven't disrupted my worldview about why that's important or what the issues are or how my clean water is a privilege and not a right where I live, I'm not going to care as much, right? And then the same thing is about people. Right now, I think the latest stat I saw was, I think 65 or 67% of nonprofit professionals are considering leaving their jobs the next year. And it's, you know, culture plays a role in that. If I'm working all the time, if I am not compensated fairly, if I'm not being able to grow and innovate, you know, I'm going to find those opportunities elsewhere.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I would contribute to that with two thoughts. First, I've talked to a lot of millennials and Gen Z employees of nonprofits, and I almost always will ask them this question. Do you want to work in the nonprofit sector? Like, do you feel like you have to work for a nonprofit or work in the sector? They're like, I mean, no, I want to work for a brand that I think is doing good and changing the world. And I don't care if it's a nonprofit. I think working in the nonprofit sector is an old school mindset. I think today, philanthrocapitalism, you can work for for-profit brands like Patagonia and Ben and Jerry's and Tesla and Tom's Shoes that are serving to change the world in some ways more powerfully than nonprofits. So I think the nonprofit sector has a huge uphill battle in retaining talent because they're no longer competing within the nonprofit sector. They're competing across the globe with brands that are way more sophisticated and effective at marketing and communicating value to their employees, many of whom care about changing the world. Liquid Death is doing a tremendous amount of good to eradicate plastic, right? They call it murder plastic. And they're a sexy, amazing brand who anybody would want to work for, and they pay pretty well. So I think there's going to be a real challenge to add value and retain, recruit, find talent in the nonprofit sector. I think for me, the second point is I find the senior leadership of nonprofits have a really hard time articulating culture. You can't scale and shape something you can't name, right? If you can't talk about it and communicate it in sticky ways, you're ultimately just hoping people catch it. And I think one of the things we help our leaders do is figure out what their culture needs to be and ways, language, a lexicon to better communicate it so that it can be scaled and cascade down across the organization, not just intuitively held.
Hmm. Let me throw, I'm interested in the, it's a totally fine and fair point that you make about, you know, corporations now actually being purpose driven and trying to effect change in the world, positive change in the world. I have an idea that I want to just throw out there, or maybe a scenario. And the question is, I'll jump to the end first, is like, in what ways should nonprofits behave more like corporations? Kind of along the lines of what you were saying. I come from video marketing or, you know, filmmaking background. And one thing that I've noticed is that a lot of my nonprofit clients, specifically small to medium nonprofits, did not operate like a business, at least in this space. And specifically what I mean is they would immediately only see video as an expense, whereas some of my corporate clients saw it as an investment. Mm. And so they would be, oh, we can't do that. We don't have enough money. Instead of like, well, do you like the idea? Because we can always get creative with the budget and how we execute the idea. But does that sound like it's aligned and it might speak to your people, et cetera, et cetera? And it would be like, oh, that's too much. And we haven't even had the money conversation. And then I have worked with nonprofits that get this right. So you can tackle that specific, you know, example, or the broader question, which is like, what success secrets, or not secrets, but strategies, can nonprofits pull from the corporate world? Because I think also they're like, they might, this is a generalization, view the corporate world as icky or whatever. Like, you know, we're nonprofits because we're over here, you know, doing philanthropy and trying to, you know, make an impact. Okay. I think I've asked the question. It's a long
Mark,
one.
You go.
Yeah. Well, I'll say, first, I think they need to start acting like brands, and specifically lifestyle brands. So most people want to take part in something to have it as a reflection of their identity, right? And so whether it's Red Bull or Liquid Death, both of those say something about me as drinks, right, that I spend way too much money on. One's water and one's an energy drink. Both of them cost way too much money.
Exactly.
For what they are, but I buy them because they say something about who I am. Yep. And again, nonprofits get so caught up in the cause, they forget that they need to meet the donors and those who they're trying to reach where they are and bring them along this journey. So how is my identity changed by being a part of this nonprofit, whether I'm volunteering or giving? And so they don't think that way. And they also have what's called a scarcity mindset, right? Instead of the abundance mindset, which is what you're talking about, that because I always have little, I have to protect what I have. instead of thinking more like a business, which is how do I grow what I have so that I can do the things that I want to do, and what risks do I need to take? What investments do I need to make? And I mean, you can see this just with Homeboy Industries, which is a gang rehabilitation program in LA. They brought in a new CEO about 10 years ago from the Fortune 500 company, and they went from like $10 million to $40 million in revenue because he got rid of that scarcity mindset. It's still there because of who they work with and their clients and how they hire ex-gang members and current gang members. And there's that scarcity mindset when you come from that background, but it's made a huge difference, right? So how, as leaders, can we do that?
Yeah, I think everything Mark said is spot on. In fact, I'm actually writing my own notes down because I think the integration of lifestyle brand with nonprofit is a brilliant way to help nonprofit leaders awaken to the gap, because nobody in the nonprofit space, in fact, they might think it's audacious, wrong, bad, or evil to think that way. Like, right. That, like, it's almost like they're the enemy. And it's like, no, they're the ones winning. They're right, the ones getting.
But when you think about Taylor Swift as a lifestyle brand, not just a musician, right? She has a, you know, an army of Swifties, right? I don't know how many people, but millions and millions of people that are fans, or Red Bull or Patagonia. Imagine your nonprofit and your cause had the same number of people willing to take action against something, right? Or for something, because they saw that as part of their identity. That would be way more powerful than, you know, a handful of people writing checks at the end of the year.
I think the thing I'm noticing the most is nonprofits are afraid to take themselves lightly or use humor or levity or be provocative with their videos or their, like, you look at agencies like 72 and Sunny and the provocative, unbelievably talented, interesting things they do for the brands they serve. Who's doing that in the nonprofit space? We need more of that. There are some, but they're usually small skunk works people who aren't, you know, they're too small to have people telling them they're wrong, right? And yeah. They're like Hannah Song from Liberty in North Korea, this incredible nonprofit brand we worked with and interviewed on Future Nonprofit, you know, just doing incredible things with humor around a really serious issue. We need more of that in the nonprofit space because it works.
Yeah. How do you, like in her case, how do you turn rescuing political refugees from North Korea and smuggling them out and relocating them into a funny YouTube video? But they figured out how to do that. And what's interesting about humor is that Oracle just released research. I think it's between 80 and 90% of consumers prefer brands to be funny. And yet most of them aren't, not just nonprofits, but even corporate brands aren't funny.
It's such an antiquated idea of like, we are professional, right? Like
we're serious,
right? Like
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
The world has changed, right? And like the internet, as vague as and broad as that is, it completely broke down these walls, right? And so no longer can the doctor be the professional who I don't ever question, because we're hip to it. We have access to information that creates its own problems sometimes. Yeah. But I'm just saying
that's a good example. My urologist has his own YouTube video and it's just all kinds of inappropriate jokes.
Right.
And it works.
So, I had like this debate with someone very close to me in the work that I do recently about this idea of like, oh no, we can't look like anything less than professional. That's what people want. And I'm like, no, people understand that you're just people. People understand that a startup has problems to overcome every single day. That's the nature of it. And that's why there is this, you know, craving for authenticity. I know that's a little overused word these days, but because we know you're no longer this, you know, this perfect business that I just send my money to and I get my product and everything's great, right? And we also yeah. care about where our money goes. Like, so right. yeah, that's such a good point. And you see it. If you're hip to and spending time on YouTube or TikTok like I do, you see it. You see the brands doing it well, making jokes, and the people responding. And listen, they buy, they purchase, they donate, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, oh. That's you know, people connect with people at the end of the day, right? And so whether it's turning a brand into a essentially a persona and personality and getting people to connect to that, or having a face that they connect with, they want to connect with people. And it's hard when it's so professional and so corporate, you lose that connection.
Yeah. I love the example you used, because it is hard to think of something like, you know, a refugee and like how to find the humor in that. Yeah. But it's possible, right? You have to be creative, and maybe you don't go to the, you know, funny route, but it's still think opening your mind of different ways you can approach it other than the, you know, typical sad, you know, sad music, you know, yeah. same thing that's been done, the Sarah McLachlan, you know.
Yeah.
Well, in the arms of an angel.
Yes. Right.
Well, I mean, World Vision is a good example of that, that World Vision Canada did that recently with making a commercial about kids burping and how inappropriate and funny it is for kids to burp. But the reason kids burp is because they have food and water. Mm. And when they don't have food and water, they don't burp, right? When they don't have full tummies, they can't burp, right? And they don't have enough to drink, they can't burp. And so it's again, that's that disruptive moment where you're laughing, right? And then at the end you realize, oh, we want every kid to have that joke because it means that they're healthy.
Yeah. Well, the thing about, you know, storytelling, and you all know this, is it's just emotion, right? That gets us. So that can be humor, right? Yeah. And it's a really effective one. And that's what, you know, gets our attention. And then we'll listen, right? Yeah. And so, but people are so reluctant to use that. Let me ask you this. In terms of what we're talking about now, what is your advice to a small, like local nonprofit? Do they use the same strategy? Or is there a different approach that they should or could take when you're two to three people, maybe one person?
When it comes to like storytelling or culture or brand?
Yeah, culture and brand and storytelling, but just these concepts that we're talking about, including the, you know, how to not operate in the scarcity mindset, including opening up and being creative, yeah. like what we're talking about, because I think it's more daunting for them to like go out on a limb.
Yeah, for sure.
I'll start with the culture piece. I think it would be really helpful for any organization, for-profit or nonprofit, but especially nonprofit, to from the very beginning articulate the behavioral principles that define how we show up and do our work. Not just the what we care about, the mission. What does it look like to be a part of this team? What are the behaviors? What are the standards? What are the things that we do that define us, maybe differentiate us in a way that we can better articulate and understand? Because so much of that is so intuitive. And then it ends up not showing up in hiring. And then it ends up. So I think brands need to be much more clear about what makes them them. And beginning to articulate that and understand that and do that work early in the process will only add dividends to their hiring and to their growth and scale, assuming they grow.
And I would say on the brand and storytelling side, smaller nonprofits have an advantage over larger nonprofits that they could test and do things that maybe larger ones wouldn't do because they're too corporate and the risk.
That's a good point.
And it's also allows them to connect personally and be more authentic, right? So I don't need to hire a huge film crew to make a video. I can make one on my iPhone and do a TikTok check-in every day at the homeless shelter or whatever and introduce people and connect people that way. And I would also say that one of the ways to be creative and innovative is to have a diverse set of ideas, which means you need a diverse set of people, backgrounds, and that's hard to do when you're small. And so think about, you know, not just volunteers and financial partners, but partners who are thought leaders or tastemakers that you can collaborate with in those times where you need to generate really great ideas, you know, whether it's a campaign or something, and to build out that volunteer team that's just helping you brainstorm stuff.
You know, it's almost ironic, because a smaller organization would benefit the most from these things and having them intact, or, you know, because they're free, right? To discuss how you approach like culture and brand is free. It's, you know, that's where you actually can gain an edge on a larger corporation in your calls, right? Yeah. But the opposite tends to happen. You know, we see what the big guys are doing or whatever, and we try to emulate that or whatever, but it's actually, they have the most to gain by going out on a limb or taking a stance and being very clear in terms of your brand. You've mentioned a few people already organically, but who else in the nonprofit space is doing it well, in your opinion?
I mean, Charity Water is one that most people talk about, right?
Yeah.
And it was interesting, last year they ran a huge YouTube campaign that was just their 20-minute documentary about Scott Harrison, the founder's personal story of starting Charity Water and why he did it, which was really moving, and again, empathy, emotion, connection, all that stuff. That's real interesting. I think Liberty North Korea is another nonprofit that is doing innovative stuff. There's a new story. They're pretty innovative. They do 3D print houses for homeless people in the in different countries, and do microfinancing and micro mortgages. And they're pretty innovative in that space. I don't know, Ted, what'd you say?
Yeah, I think on the larger scale of, you know, nonprofits, those, you know, I think there are some large nonprofits that operate just like a complete institution and, you know, very behind the times. But then there are some who are really huge, but operating with all this great innovative energy and prioritizing innovation. And for me, those would include Oxfam. Oxfam has a director of innovation who is given a lot of influence and power and authority within the organization, Latte Lawson-Latergo, an amazing guy, Dr. Latte Lawson-Latergo. So I think Oxfam is really a great example of a large brand not letting its age and legacy build a crust that prevents it from being relevant or helpful. And then I think what we're seeing happen with the World Food Program and some of the innovation work being done there is profound. And again, I think it's producing incredible results within a gigantic nonprofit that is seeking world change. They have some incredible people doing some great things.
And on the smaller side, I think $4, which is a patient advocacy organization that works with patients to get their medical bills basically deleted. So there's a law called Charity Care in the United States, and that means every hospital that is a nonprofit has to provide free medical care to keep their tax status. And this organization has a database that, you know, has scanned all of the websites and pulled all that information in, and they work with patients. But they're basically like a TikTok first nonprofit, like as far as like how they blew up and became famous and grew is all through TikTok and social media. And the interesting thing about that organization is Jared Walker, their founder and CEO, his innovation comes through being super humble. So if you're small, like they were, and you don't know what you're doing, like, ask people, like, own the fact that you may not have enough experience, and go find those who do, and be humble and get mentoring and get coaching, and you'd be surprised like how quick you can grow as an organization when you're a humble leader.
Since you mentioned social media and TikTok specifically, I usually do biannually big online summit for Community Boost, which is like a nonprofit fundraising organization. And always the people are there interested in storytelling content or storytelling sessions, which is, you know, normally what I'm speaking on. What are the ways, like, for those listening, this is the Storytelling Lab after all, What are the ways and why should someone in communications or marketing at a nonprofit lean on that skill of storytelling? Because we have so many different ways that you can use it, not just TikTok or video, but within all of their messaging. Why?
I think there's a macro storytelling strength that is brand centric. And so many brands we find in the nonprofit space just don't tell a good macro story. Their macro brand messaging is out of alignment. It's not compelling. It's stat heavy instead of compelling and engaging for the end user. And, you know, I think that that storytelling skill is something people who can write decently think they have, but writing well and telling a story are very different skills.
Yeah, there's most nonprofits we interact with, I will say, have testimonies, not story.
Yeah,
stories. And so
say more, please.
Yeah. So I have a whole soapbox on this. So get ready.
Get on it.
So testimonies is information based. So our nonprofit, through your donations, we're able to house 100 homeless people this winter, so yeah, they didn't die stats in the storm, right? That is a testimony. Story is actually narrative built on, whether good storytellers know it or not, neuroscience. So there are things that happen in our brain that get us to remember things. So most people make decisions, actually almost all people based on research, makes decisions based off of emotion and then back those decisions based off of logic, right? When it comes to purchasing. And so the emotional part of your brain, or the limbic system, is the strongest part of the brain. And that's, it stores things that it can then recall later, that the prefrontal cortex will then use as justification, you know, to try to make sense of these things. But so you want to activate that. And the way that happens is by people imagining in their mind's eye the story. And so whether that's I'm watching a video and then I can see myself in that video as either as the main character, as a bystander, but I'm just immersed in that video, or I'm reading something or listening to something and that same thing happens, I start to imagine it in my brain. When that happens, it's actually activating the limbic part of your system, and you're storing pieces of that story in your brain, in your memory. And the only way that happens is through specific details that trigger our own senses. So this is called narrative transportation. And so if you don't have like specific details that would trigger one of the five senses, like, you know, we walked into a room and it smelled, the urine was so bad it smelled like ammonia, like instantly everyone knows what that means, right? Like, and so you can start imagining what that is in your brain already. And so people don't realize that if your story isn't doing that, you're not activating the part of your brain that's actually going to remember that story, that's activating the emotional part. Then there's a bunch of other things that you can layer on top of that. So that's called narrative transportation. You need to activate some of the one of the five senses or a few of them. And then on top of that, there are three key chemicals that you want to leverage in your storytelling in your brain. So that's cortisol, oxytocin, and dopamine. Cortisol is the thing that if you are into action movies or spy movies like I am, that like thriller feel, like I don't know what's going to happen next. That anxiety, that rush, adrenaline feeling that you have is cortisol. And when you have a cliffhanger, your brain is going to kick that in, and that's going to create the need to kind of fulfill what that open loop is, right? Which is another term in storytelling. And so you want to create that, so that creates the desire to continue engaging in the story. Whereas oxytocin is the relationship you build with the characters, right? That's going to come out of connection, right? We always say, like, why do people want to see authentic content? It's actually because there's a chemical in their brain that happens when they do, and it makes it feels good, and that's oxytocin, right? That's the relationship and connection chemical. So how are we connecting with the heroes or the subjects in the story? Are we building relationship with them? And then finally, dopamine. This is the happy outcome part, right? This is the thing that we're always like, you eat a bunch of your favorite cake or candy or whatever, it's going to spike your dopamine, right? And that's, how are you actually making that change in the individual's lives that you talked about in the story, and on a macro level too, that happy outcome or happy ending, that's the dopamine. And so those are like some just high level key components that we don't even realize as good storytellers we're doing, but it needs to be there for people to engage.
And if it's not already obvious, the reason all this stuff matters is because the brands that fail to make radical emotional connection with their audience will fail. The game is emotional connection, and stats don't do that. Poverty porn won't do that. Right. You have to tell a story, make a connection, and not just presume or assume that your cause matters to everybody as much as it matters to you.
Right. Mm. And as even small organizations realize the science behind storytelling, you don't need to spend $1 million on a video.
Right.
No. You could do it in a podcast. You can do it on your phone. You can do it in an email. And it's a huge unlock.
I had a potential nonprofit client contact me one time, and they showed me this spot that they wanted to create something very similar, not completely bite it, but you know, it inspired it. I'll use that word. And it was a Nike spot, and made by Wyden and Kennedy, right? Like, it probably cost $2 million. And, you know, they showed me, I was like, okay, I get it. And they really wanted to like replicate a lot of what it had. It had tons of extras, et cetera, et cetera. And they came away with like, we've got $5,000. And I tried to explain to them, I was like, this probably cost $1 million to make. Like, we got to come at it from a different angle. Like, talk about the emotion that we want to conjure up. Talk about the impact we're trying to have, who we're trying to, you know, yada, yada, yada. And then we can think about a creative way to do it. Like, you're right. It doesn't have to cost a lot. But when you still just try to compare yourself or operate as a company that's using one of the best agencies in the world ever.
Yeah.
You will always lose that battle. If you tried to replicate that video with $5,000, it's not happening.
And your donors and your audience that you're trying to reach know it when they see it, and it's just, you know, a rip off something else, and it's low quality. And the low quality isn't even the production. It's just that the idea itself was low quality because you just had to copy.
That's the beauty of where we are now with content creation, is like you can do low quality. Like people don't care about that as much. They respond more to somebody just kind of rattling off the dome at their camera, you know, often, right? They still like good production, but you don't have to have it these days. That's what frustrates me sometimes is like the little guys. You have so much opportunity now. Like, think the playing field is evening out in a lot of ways in terms of marketing.
I mean, I think an example of that that's really interesting is one of Old Spice's most successful campaigns wasn't the elaborate commercials that they were making, but it was one set, one camera, and a guy on Twitter, formerly Twitter, that is like they're making videos that people are tweeting comments about at them in real time and just posting that, and they saw the largest spike in one day sales ever in their history because of that campaign. Granted, their quality was high because they were using an agency, but like that format, right, is just one camera.
It didn't have to be. It wasn't the production quality that made that compelling. No.
Right. It was just that I'm responding in real time to you with video, which like what? So thinking about like how you could do that. Like, and going back to the advantage of small nonprofits, you have an opportunity to create high touch moments that larger organizations are going to struggle all the time. And you can use content and storytelling to do that.
Absolutely. Well said. You all have been working together, like your agency has been up for a while now, right?
About 10 years.
What led you to the, like, do you work first of all exclusively with nonprofits or just predominantly? Yes, no.
Well, Mark, you answered that because I'll get it wrong.
Yeah. So predominantly nonprofits. Occasionally, we'll work with cause-driven for-profits, but our specialty is in the nonprofit space.
I mean, here's what I'll say about that, really, really quick. Since we're talking about culture, there's nothing more complex organizationally than a nonprofit. Maybe the most complex nonprofit's a faith-based nonprofit, because you've got theology, mission, relationship, professional connection, and an expectation of sacrificing. If you can figure out how to navigate those tensions well, It's unbelievable what you learn, the wisdom you glean that applies to the for-profit space. The nonprofit space is incredibly complex, and getting it right is why I feel like we're so equipped to help organizations outside the nonprofit space, but our heart, passion, and work is almost entirely nonprofit.
Well, so what led you all to make that conscious choice? Because it is complex and it is challenging. Why?
We're all nonprofit people. We care about making the world better. We understand the complexity. We have a passion for it. We feel called to that sector. And it's huge enough. It's big enough. It's giant on its own.
Yeah, about 1.5 million nonprofits in the United States. I think, too, it's also that we... It's something that we evolved over time. We have always worked with nonprofits, but also worked with small businesses and other types of organizations, and or big businesses, banks, higher ed. But I think what we found was that we were uniquely suited as leaders to speak insight and truth, if you will, to nonprofit organizations in a way that was winsome and funny and self-deprecating, and it allowed for change to happen. And so we kind of just kept doing it, and more doors opened up.
Well, I think I'm making an assumption here, but I think that also when you realize the significance of the impact that you can have on a group of people or organizations, it makes it more fulfilling, you know, for that to be like what you focus your career on. So did you have that kind of moment, you know, where it was just like, look, we're really kind of helping.
I mean, Mark's talking about those emotions, those chemicals, you know, I think in some ways when we contribute in helping a brand, we care about who we believe is doing good in the world, be better, do more good, be more effective. It really is compelling, and it really does feel like we're actually contributing to making the world better. Not that for-profit brands don't make the world better. Many of them do, and there's a great case. In fact, I would say any of the for-profit brands we make, we're working with them as out of extension of a nonprofit, board member on a nonprofit who's running a very purpose-driven for-profit, right? Mm-hmm. So that can be fulfilling as well. But usually the nonprofits are just in more need. A bigger mess.
So I'm curious, you've all worked together. Did you work together before the agency, like in the past 10 years?
Yeah, we met because I was doing a lot of higher level strategy vision type work, and I didn't know where to go for brand and design, and Mark did and was really creative and talented in that space. So I would just keep calling Mark, and at the time, a guy named Jeremy we worked with, and eventually we were like, why don't we just bootstrap something and kind of make it work? And we did, and it worked. And then we went through the journey of taking all the work I was doing in culture and vision and strategy and integrating that into our design thinking agency and really reforming ourselves from the inside out. And that's really what led to the book and the idea that culture and brand are the same conversation. And strategy is the foundation under both of them.
Mm-hmm. I was going to get to the book. I'm glad you led us there. But I think I might have the answer. I'm going to ask the question anyway. Like, I'm curious about writing, like co-writing the book. I know you're not the first to do it. I think about it too when I see two directors, right? It's got to be challenging. And also, aren't you tired of each other yet? How did you approach?
We live in different states.
So that, yeah, that helped.
I see you in two.
But
it had to be challenging to create this thing that is generally driven by one individual. It's their thoughts that they are putting out to the world. How did you approach that?
Well, I think we have unique personalities that allow us to take different sides to the book. So a lot of the research in more technical stuff is on my side, and Ted is speaking into the stories and the culture and the perspective from the leader. And so those seem to work well together. I don't know, Ted, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think Mark and I have very different gifts and styles, but they're incredibly complementary, very yin and yang. And I think that shows up in the work we do in the agency, in our consultancy. I mean, you know, I have thoughts on creativity and design, but Mark's gifted in that space. I'm gifted in leadership and culture, and Mark has incredible insight. So I think in many ways we respect each other's lanes, but also understand and have input and huge respect for each other's perspective. So it works well. And I also think the journey we've been on over 10 years, it's unbelievably compelling to kind of grow and figure stuff out and keep surviving. You know, like, I mean, 50% of success is survival, right? So just the journey of survival and figuring it out is actually unbelievably fun and compelling if you're not shedding too much blood in the process.
It's like the, you know, play-by-play guy and the color commentator, you know, you need them both to get that complete experience, right? All right, final question. What would you like to see nonprofits leverage more going into 2024 and beyond in this new age, you know, AI? And I mean, I'm not suggesting that's your answer, but just the world is changing, boys.
Yeah.
What would you like to see them lean on more in the near future?
I'll answer with something we talked about earlier. I would like to see them better leverage their stakeholders, primarily staff, by understanding how they can add value to their staff, how the value prop for their staff can be just as real and powerful and tangible as it is for the donors. Because I think most staff and most nonprofits are on the edge of burnout, are working as some sort of martyr, which is unhealthy and toxic. And the more we can fix that, the more we will see nonprofits blossom and grow. I would bet there's a roughly 1/3 of the productivity in nonprofits is wasted by sideways energy, drama, lack of efficiency. And I think figuring out how to grow the health and add the value to the nonprofit staff is going to be a huge leverage for growth and health. And most people miss that because they're all just busy bleeding for the cause.
Yeah. I would say not necessarily AI, but the need to have a space for innovation within the organization so that AI would fall into that, and whatever comes after AI would fall into that. But you need people within the organization that are forward-looking, thinking about how do we do things differently. You know, getting rid of the "this is the way it's always been done" phrase that a lot of people in nonprofits will say sometimes, and taking that seriously, because the average tenure of a Fortune 500 or S&P 500 company used to be 60 years on the S&P 500. In the next few years, the average lifespan will be 12, and most of the top 10 companies in the world didn't exist 60 years ago. And some of them didn't exist 20 years ago or 10 years ago. So, nonprofits will be in that same boat if we don't, start taking innovation seriously. And more importantly, the problems will still exist. You know, it's crazy that extreme poverty is still a problem when there is enough food in the world to feed everybody. It's a challenge when we spend so much. You know, the United States is the largest giver of funds per capita in the world, yet we still have so many problems. So,
yeah, I don't think the role of nonprofits is going away anytime soon, even though we do have these for-profit, purpose-driven companies out there. Mark, Ted, thank you so much. The authors of Culture Built My Brand, which the design is incredible. I'll reiterate. I love the cover. Thank you. I appreciate it, man. Like the way you all explain concepts that I was familiar with was still like extremely eye-opening for me, the way you worded them, the soil.
Thank you.
But yeah, I appreciate your time so much. And I come from a place where I've been serving and working with nonprofits for almost 20 years now too. So, it's a big part of my heart. And so, especially appreciate these kinds of episodes because it helps the people that I seek to help too. So thank you for your time. Yeah. Appreciate you being here.
Grateful to be here. Thank you.
All right. Have a great day, guys.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
My name is Rain Bennett. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed that episode, do us a favor and subscribe to the podcast. If you're already a subscriber and you're enjoying the show, give us a review and let us know the value that you've gotten from it. We love to hear from our listeners and learn about the benefits that they're getting from the show. That's what fuels us, and that's what fuels the show. And if you've already subscribed and you've already reviewed it and you think there's someone else that would benefit from listening to this show, please, please share it with them. The more we grow, the more we can help you grow, and that's what we're here to do. Join us next time on the Storytelling Lab. This podcast is a 6 Second Stories production. 6 Second Stories is a story coaching and consulting company that builds online education, in-person and virtual training, and digital products that help businesses master storytelling to find their ideal customers and market to them effectively.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
You can learn more at 6secondstories.com and purchase the book 6 Second Stories at Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, or rainbennett.com/6secondstories.